Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions. The audiobook version is broadcast with permission from Blackstone Audio.
Peltonen led the way back to the loading dock, but then he noticed Jacob handling the merchandise. "Can I help you?" he said. He was polite, but J.W. could sense an undercurrent of suspicion. Jacob looked up, and J.W. saw a different boy, as if through Peltonen's eyes. His demeanor suddenly seemed surly. His court shoes loosely tied, his baggy shorts, his loose-jointed, long-fingered movements. "I'm okay," Jacob said, without making eye contact. Manny stood for a moment, his eyes running from Jacob to the merchandise rack and back. J.W. realized what was going through his mind. He didn't want to leave the suspicious Native American boy in the store unattended. "He's with me," he said. Manny turned to look at him, his eyebrows furrowing and his face recoiling in surprise. "Him? Oh, well then, let's go get your grain." His face immediately softened. He grinned, but his eyes lingered briefly on Jacob as he walked past. He led J.W. outside onto the loading dock. He strolled over to the open garage door. "Be right back." Peltonen grabbed a sack dolly and disappeared. J.W. heard him throwing sacks, and then he reappeared, wheeling 6 50-pound bags of 14% protein sweet feed, a mix of oats, cracked corn, pellet meal, and molasses. He parked the load behind the truck's tailgate and helped J.W. swing the bags into the bed. As they worked, J.W. noticed Jacob loitering inside the big window. "Got yourself a stall boy, huh?" "Something like that." J.W. watched as Jacob, unseen by Peltonen, stuck a pack of cigars into his shirt. "They're good for that," Peltonen went on, his back still turned to the boy. "Just keep 'em away from your liquor cabinet, eh?" Peltonen winked at J.W. He set a catch on the feed dolly so it wouldn't tip, and they tossed the last of the bags into the pickup truck. J.W. nodded and smiled thinly as Jacob wandered casually out. "Thanks," he said. Jacob came over, and the two of them got in the truck and pulled out. J.W. handed a Dorothy's to Jacob and opened the other. He took a long sip. The soda had been created by a woman who lived alone like some Finnish Madiraka on an island in the Boundary Waters. In winter, she harvested lake ice and stored it draped in sawdust. In summer, she used it to cool the brew she sold to paddlers. She had no power, no water, and no neighbors. Surrounded by 2 million acres, she was arguably the most isolated woman in America, a goddess of the lakes. She was gone now, but Dorothy's root beer had become an iconic drink of the Northland. "Thanks," said Jacob, and twisted the top off. J.W. thought about what had just happened as he drove down the side streets heading for the highway, the dream catcher swaying. The cigars were faintly visible through Jacob's shirt. He pulled over and shifted into park. Jacob looked up at him. "What's up?" He shut the engine off. "What the hell was that all about?" "What?" Jacob was confused and defensive. "You like cigars?" "No." He looked offended now, but J.W. could see an artery thumping in the side of his neck. "Really? What are you talking about?" "They're in your shirt. Right there." He reached over and tapped the box through the fabric. Jacob swatted his hand away. "Don't f***ing touch me." He looked away out the window, busted and humiliated. J.W. shook his head. "Look, I'm not going to waste your time telling you about right and wrong. But I think you're stronger than that. Actually, I know you're stronger than that. I've seen it." Jacob looked down. He fumbled and almost dropped the bottle, but quickly caught it, then had to slurp up the foam from the top. "You don't have to act out people's stereotypes," J.W. continued. "Those stupid kids or that asshole in there. You're smarter than them. Beat their expectation. Fight it. There are plenty of other places where people don't think like this. Like where? J.W. sighed. Just take my word for it. Look, you do what you want. Maybe you want this kind of life. But if you want to give those cigars back, I'd be proud to stand beside you. Jacob looked up at him, his face full of worry. A few long moments later, they stepped back into the feed store. Beyond the glass case full of hunting knives, Manny was reading a newsletter on bedding plants.
You're back. Did you forget something?
No, replied J.W. He turned and saw that Jacob was petrified, with no idea what to say or how to broach the subject. He put a hand on the boy's shoulder. My friend Jacob here's got something to say. Jacob set the cigars on the counter.
Sorry, he mumbled. It was a mistake.
Manny looked at the cigars, then back at Jacob. His wrinkled, watery eyes became small and hard.
You stole those from me.
He decided to bring them back, said J.W. Manny saw the firm expression on J.W.'s face and registered the tone in his voice. He looked back at Jacob. His expression was now somewhat cowed.
I could call the cops right now and have you arrested. They'd throw you in jail, he said.
Jacob stared at the floor. The thin wooden planks had been worn bare long ago.
I know, he said, his voice barely audible.
Manny looked back at J.W.
You put him up to this.
No, sir, it was his decision. But I'd say it's a pretty honorable thing when a guy admits what he's done and owns up to it himself. Wouldn't you? Manny stared into his eyes for several seconds, then looked at Jacob and nodded toward the door. Get out of here. They drove back through the side streets in silence and turned onto the main highway. Jacob spent most of the ride picking at the label of his root beer bottle. Finally, J.W. reached over and shook him by the shoulder.
Stop it,
Jacob protested, stifling a grin. Wind blew in through the open windows.
You did a really good thing there, J.W. said. I'm really proud of you. It's tough to be your own man.
Okay, enough, said Jacob. But then he smiled and laughed awkwardly.
Come on, I mean it.
J.W. smiled and took a long draft of his root beer as they drove out among the farm fields. The warm fall breeze blew in through the windows, ruffling their hair, and outside combines spewed yellow streams of grain into their wagons. He turned on Clapton, and for a brief moment, he didn't have a care in the world. Chapter 20 J.W. and Jacob unloaded the bags of sweet feed into the lean-to. They pulled the white cotton stitching, and the brown smell of molasses filled the air. Pride nickered his excitement. Jacob took the lids off two steel garbage cans, and they poured the sticky contents inside.
You ever feed him wild rice? J.W. asked. It's pretty good protein.
Oh, yeah, Jacob said. He loves it. They put the lids back, and Jacob dumped a scoop of feed into Pride's bucket. He threw two flakes of hay in the rack. As the horse munched on the feed, Jacob went into the stall, threw a saddle blanket on him, and started to saddle him up.
You may not want to do that while he's eating, J.W. said.
But Pride didn't seem to mind. He kept his nose in his black rubber bucket, his eyes closed, savoring the sticky brown oats and corn. Jacob threaded the cinch strap through the buckle and pulled it tight. He selected reins and a headstall with a snaffle bit, the most gentle, and hung it on the saddle horn until Pride finished. Out at the paddock, J.W. leaned on the rails and watched as Jacob rode around the ring. Earlier in the week, just getting a saddle on the horse and getting up on his back had been an accomplishment. Over the past few days, it had become routine. But now it was different again. Pride started fast and kept it up. Jacob looked barely in control.
Don't let him truck out on you, J.W. instructed.
He could tell from the way Jacob was riding that he was nervous. The boy was squeezing with his knees and leaning forward, which made the horse trot, and then he was pulling on the reins to slow him down. Using a snaffle bit made him pull even harder than he should, craning the horse's head high and back. Pride was starting to fight and to ignore the bit, which made Jacob squeeze his knees harder. J.W. knew that telling the legs to run and pulling the head back was a recipe for a horse to rear up and go over, landing on the rider. "Give him his head," he instructed. "Give him his head. Let the reins go." Jacob loosened the reins, and Pride kept up his fast trot, prancing around the perimeter. He stopped fighting the bit and lowered his head. "That's good. Now you got him going good. Don't keep making him truck out on you. Relax those knees. Let your legs dangle. Sit back and loosen your back. If you're relaxed, he's relaxed. And keep those reins loose." J.W. knew how hard this was. Making yourself relax when you were nervous was challenging. It was even harder while maintaining your balance on the back of a 1,200-pound animal that was in motion and barely under control. In fact, the horse was just trying to follow Jacob's conflicting instructions, but loosening the reins and relaxing your legs seemed counterintuitive if the goal was more control. "Put it all on your butt. Imagine you got Velcro on your seat. Stick your butt to the horse. Let your legs dangle. Your hips absorb the shock. I want to see you still from the hips up." Jacob let the horse go and relaxed his legs. Sure enough, things slowed down in less than a length of the riding paddock. Jacob was still stiff, but Pride slowed to a gentle trot. J.W. gave him a thumbs up, and Jacob broke into a wide grin. After the lesson, they ate barbecued ribs and corn at Eagle's great wooden table. J.W. reminisced about growing up in North Lake, how he had not been born into privilege but had married the town princess, and how he had applied himself, eventually becoming a bank president. Eagle held him up as an example to Jacob.
"You could do the same thing," he said.
J.W. smiled, thinking of the bank Eagle was secretly building. Eagle probably did have that job in mind for Jacob someday in the distant future. Outside the open screen door, the tree leaves were glowing yellow-green in the early evening light. He reached for another rib. He heard the sound of loud rap music approaching, and then a car pulled past the house. Its bass thundered and buzzed the window panes. He heard it pull into the neighbor's driveway, and then the booming bass cut out. Two car doors slammed, followed by the high cymbal of a woman's laughter.
"Your neighbor sure does love to party," J.W. said to Eagle.
He was nervous about the subject, but he also needed to know where he stood. Eagle ignored the comment and took three more ribs from the plate in the middle.
"She's my aunt," said Jacob, glancing at J.W. and then looking down at his food.
Eagle shot him an angry glance.
"What?"
Jacob asked in an innocent tone.
"We don't talk about her," Eagle replied, intending the statement more for J.W.
He nodded, getting the shape of things.
"Jacob's really making progress with Pride," he said, changing the subject.
"Yeah?
Real progress. He's a nice horse." "J.W. says he's maybe worth $20,000,
Jacob blurted out.
"20?
Eagle was shocked.
"You're kidding."
"Well, he's still a stud," said J.W., "which is rare. Good bloodlines to boot. If Jacob gets him cleaned up and performing at his best, Pride has real income potential. We've financed horses like him for upwards of 15 at the bank."
Eagle laughed.
"I'll tell you what, if Jacob can sell him for 20 at the fair, he gets half and you get the other half."
"We already made a deal. He'd keep it all for college," J.W. replied.
"I'd split it with you," offered Jacob. J.W. nodded noncommittally and took another rib.
"It would rightly be yours."
He saw Eagle's wry smile. After dinner, he went outside and sat on Eagle's front deck, watching the great swaths of a sweeping sunset. Purple washed into pink, to yellow, and then to a deep fireball orange, like chalk in the rain. The screen door clapped shut behind him. Eagle tapped his shoulder with a wet bottle of Summit EPA. He took it, and Eagle sat down next to him.
"Sure is pretty out here." J.W. took a sip of the amber brew. "I don't know why your people are always complaining about living on the res."
Which of my people are those?
I don't know. You know, activists.
Maybe they're just irritated at being lumped together and told where and how to live.
J.W. chuckled.
Maybe. Whole country's getting angry, it seems. And everybody wants special rights.
You all get gambling.
Eagle snorted. We didn't get gambling. We always had it. These reservations are sovereign land.
You and I know that's only true part of the time. But your point's well taken.
Besides, said Eagle, remember when white men used to get the Injuns drunk and take all their money?
J.W. laughed. Touché. He held up his bottle, and Eagle clinked it with his. No, it wasn't anybody's fault but mine. How I screwed up my life, J.W. said. He looked out over the landscape, picking at the beer label. My son died. My son died, and he shook his head. I couldn't handle it. It's all I could think about. I just sort of wound up down there, passing time. All those lights, little voices in the machines. He laughed and fluttered his fingers as if they were sparkling with fairy dust. Then he took another sip and looked out over the sunset. It all began as a distraction. I would have grabbed at anything, I suppose. He closed his eyes, seeing it all clearly for the first time. He had been a fool, trying to control the uncontrollable over and over. And now here he was, trapped by his own weaknesses.
What was his name?
Eagle said softly. J.W. looked at him with a start, drawn back out of his reverie. Chris. Christopher John White. I tried to call him C.J., but it never took. He hated it. He smiled and shrugged.
How did he die?
It was a car crash just outside of town. Bob Grossman said he was high and drunk. A one-car crash, thankfully. Deer jumped out and he lost control. Totally random. The real kicker? I was supposed to help him with his brakes the night before, but because it was the end of the month, I was working overtime at the bank. Ego blew out air.
I'm sorry.
J.W. nodded and sipped his beer, towed some sand on the sidewalk. It doesn't matter, he said. You just have to learn to deal with it. Or not. He chuckled painfully.
It's hard to know what people need, said Eagle. I wasn't there enough for my wife either.
J.W. glanced over at him, but Eagle just picked at his bottle label. It was clear he didn't want to say more. J.W. studied his beer bottle. I feel different now, he said. At least when it comes to the gambling. Cured by the snake that bit me, I guess. Eagle glanced over and saw that J.W. was barely hiding a smile. Seriously, though, J.W. continued, I am reading the big book. But being out here, I don't know. Somehow it's taking me back to my youth. Making things more bearable. Eagle nodded.
Someday I hope we won't need casinos, he said.
J.W. nodded. There was a brief silence before he spoke again. Why don't you work toward that, then, he said. His heart was racing. While the exchange had developed naturally, this was the moment he had been working toward since he first got out here. Set up a bank, he suggested. It's what you do. I mean, the wild rice business is nice, but you could get some economic development going. Let's face it, there's no one else up here that could do what you do. Eagle regarded his summit, the ochre grains on the label glowing in the long rays of the sunset. The paper was wrinkling from the moisture.
You want to help me?
Eagle kept staring at the bottle, his expression unchanged, and with his thumb he began to peel off the label.
You probably figured that's what the new building is.
He glanced at J.W. J.W. suddenly felt cautious. He looked away. Was this a trap?
We just got our last bit of capital, Eagle went on. Treasury's been dragging their feet for some reason, but we're going to submit our national charter application on Monday.
Wow. You're really doing it. The telephone rang somewhere inside the house.
It's about time my people had a bank. You would know that better than anyone. What do you say? You want to be our token white boy? I could pay you a little more than I can for bagging rice.
J.W. saw that Eagle was smiling wryly, offering friendship and a new future, free of his past, free of the things that had trapped him, perhaps, or at least free of what he had done in response to them. He took a sudden deep breath. Jacob burst out through the screen door.
Dad, he said, there's a fire!
Chapter 21. Eagle's Bank was burning. J.W. could see the orange flames blossoming through the trees as the pickup lurched recklessly over the bumpy reservation road. They crunched to a stop next to an idling tribal tanker truck and scrambled out into the night. The flames blew 30 and 40 feet high, gulping and roaring with a thunderous power. The tribal firemen rushed to hook up a new hose. A breeze was blowing, feeding the flames up into great gobs that woofed up over their heads. The heat blasted them, burning their faces and the backs of their hands. The big diesel tanker powered two massive water pumps that snapped the fire hoses taut, shooting powerful blasts into the sky. Three Indian firefighters directed water at the downwind vegetation, while two others kept their hose trained on the building. Orange reflections raced back up the giant arcs, as if the flames were fighting their way back toward the brass nozzles.
"We can't get it, Johnny. It's too big,"
the fire chief yelled over the hum of the engines.
"You gotta get more water on it. We got the other tanker going for another load. We gotta soak the brush to keep it from spreading, or else we'll have a wildfire."
J.W. looked down the slope to the county highway where two North Lake fire engines idled, a large pumper and a tanker, their emergency lights turning blue and yellow. City firefighters were standing on the shoulder in yellow slickers, smoking cigarettes and talking.
"What about them?" Eagle yelled. "We canned the agreement with them when we opened our own fire department," the chief yelled.
He powered down one of the massive pumps and started working the big brass union of the slackening fire hose. Water began pouring from the coupling. Eagle turned to J.W.
"I need your help," he said.
He jogged down the rocky construction access road to the highway. J.W. followed him down the makeshift gravel driveway and then along the shoulder to where the North Lake volunteer firefighters had congregated with their two vehicles. Tony Amaretto, the city fire chief, was a short man with dark hair and a mustache. He stepped forward to intercept them. Eagle was yelling at him even before he stopped running.
"Can't you people see we need help?"
he said, sounding outraged.
"Yes, I can," Amaretto said. He had the soft voice of an old drinker, and he lifted his hands in a gesture of helplessness. "We don't have a cooperative service agreement. We're just here to make sure it doesn't spread."
Eagle turned to J.W. as they stopped, full of disbelief.
"This is crazy," he said.
J.W. appealed to the fire chief, who was an old buddy from the local curling club.
"Tony, come on. Be a neighbor, eh? What harm can it do?"
"I wish we could, J.W.
"I'll guarantee it," Eagle said, his voice desperate. "I'll guarantee your costs."
Amaretto looked genuinely upset.
"I'm sorry. There's legal issues. Unless the county directs us, if we don't have a CSA, we don't have insurance. One of our guys gets hurt, he's not covered."
The trucks sat there rumbling, and J.W. saw the faces of the firefighters as they stood around on the shoulder or sat inside the vehicles, watching.
"This is insane," said Eagle, raising his voice. "I'm begging you."
Up at the construction site, the empty tribal tanker was backing out. Behind it, another one had arrived and was getting into position. J.W. could hear the beeping over the roar as it backed up.
"Take it up with the tribal council," said Amaretto. "I wish I could do more, J.W. We got it straight from the city attorney."
"And don't build right on the edge of the damn town until you can provide proper fire protection,"
a firefighter called out from near the cab. Amaretto held up a hand to silence him. He looked apologetically from Eagle to J.W. J.W. nodded.
"I'm sorry, Johnny," he said.
Eagle shook his head in disbelief, then jogged back up the hill. J.W. turned to Amaretto.
"I gotta go help him," he said,
then started after Eagle. He saw him pick up a slackened hose and connect it to the new tanker.
Okay, go!
The tribal fire chief yelled as J.W. arrived at the top of the hill. The tanker driver powered up the main pump, and the hose snapped stiff with water. The firefighters bore in against it, aiming its nozzle, and a blast leaped out onto the fire. But it was a containment operation now. As if to confirm this, the roof collapsed, sending out a blast of heat followed by an 80-foot plume of sparks that dispersed like fireflies to heaven. Eagle put his arm around Jacob and drew him close. J.W. stood helplessly behind in the dark, watching their glistening silhouettes as they watched Eagle's dream burn. By the time the remaining wall fell into the fire with another enormous blast of sparks, J.W. had a sense that something permanent had forever changed between them. The tribal fire chief put a hand on Eagle's shoulder. He turned him toward the pickup.
"There's nothing more you can do," he said, waving J.W. over to join them. "Don't torture yourselves."
Eagle looked as if he didn't understand. Jacob tugged at his arm, and Eagle put an arm around his shoulder, and the two of them began walking toward the truck. J.W. followed. They drove home through a tunnel of darkness and leaves, the roar of the fire echoing in their minds, choking out other thoughts. Finally, Eagle slowed to a stop on the road in front of J.W.'s trailer, and the roar transformed into the raging thunder of crickets. They sat there for a moment, at a loss for words. J.W. finally reached up and hooked two fingers around the door handle.
"Johnny," he said, "I'm so sorry."
Eagle laughed with disgust.
"You know," he said, his voice hard with a bitterness J.W. hadn't heard before, "I find it funny that you lost your job and just happened to move in next door to me and my son. You get my son thinking you're this great guy."
"Dad!" Eagle raised his hand and grasped the air. He dropped his hand to his knee and looked at J.W. in the glow of the dashboard. His eyes were inflamed.
"What do you know about this?"
J.W. turned his head away and looked ahead at the yellow road, the bugs flitting in and out of the headlights, bumping blindly over and over at the glass.
"Nothing solid," he said. "It could have been anyone from the town, even Grossman. Or it could have been Oily Rags." But he had a strong suspicion.
You have been listening to Episode 13 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 14 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.
I stole a Bible from a hotel room. I can't pay the bill and check out time is noon. Someone double-crossed me, left me out to dry. Now all I can do is pray and hope an angel happens by. They said you'll never be nothing, you're just a dead-end kid. Probably end up in prison, or maybe down on the skids.